in a world full of straight people. Aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
We're just going to sit in silence for a moment. For
yeah. I appreciate that.
It's traditional. Yeah.
We like to start with a prayer and a long meditation, but you know that you've listened to some episodes. No, Dave, we're sitting in silence. I think it's reverence is why we were sitting in silence, because
that's what I'd like to call it.
A very important guest here. He produced and directed 6 Feet Under, Tales of a City, My So-Called Life, The Newsroom, many, many more. Most recently, Tokyo Vice on Max. Alan Poole, hello.
Alan.
Thank you. I feel like I shouldn't say anything. It's all downhill after that introduction.
Stop. But truly, Alan, you have been involved in like several things that have been pivotal to both of us.
Thank you very much.
Big time.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to get into all of them, but you've obviously made so much great television, but is there anything you have seen lately that really inspired you?
Well, you know, it's Oscar time and it's voting season. And as a member of the Academy, I have to admit that the past couple of months have been mostly trying to catch up on all the movies of the year and haven't been quite as wide reaching in my television viewing. Also, I happen to have just launched a television show, which sort of occupied every waking hour until the time we were ready to give birth to it. But do movies count?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Tell us about your movie favorites.
I would
say your ballot, if you will.
I'm not going to reveal my ballot. Actually, the final voting just opened today, so probably sometime tomorrow I'll go in and cast my votes. But there's a movie that we watched. My husband and I watched over the weekend called The Taste of Things. Are you familiar with that?
Is this the Juliette Binoche?
Yeah,
one?
And it's kind of hasn't gotten as much attention as it should. It's brilliant, and we are days later still being transported by it. It's and Juliette Binoche, she's like, she's new to the pantheon, she's my new goddess. Based on that, the next night we went and I started watching The New Look, her Apple TV series about Chanel and the Nazis, which is, I prefer her as the cook in The Taste of Things than as a rather tart Coco Chanel, but still she is, I feel like she is the French actress of the moment and completely sublime whatever she does.
What else this Oscar season are you enjoying?
Well, I've enjoyed so much, but I mean, aside from, there's the obvious, I mean, obviously I know you had Andrew Hay on not long ago, and you know, All of Us Strangers is my favorite film of the year, hands down. That's just, I think it's not just Andrew's greatest film to date, it's also a masterpiece and one of the most profoundly moving experiences I've had in the cinema this year. But I also, although it's quite different, was profoundly affected by Zone of Interest. I don't know if you've seen that. That's the We Have a Pretty House and Garden with Auschwitz Just Beyond the Wall movie, which is also bone chilling, but an extraordinary piece of work done with such artistry and originality and sensitivity by Jonathan Glazer. Those are sort of my top two at present. I also, you guys may or may not know, you know, I have a background in Japan, which is part of why I came to be working on Tokyo Vice. So I tend to watch as many Japanese movies as I can too when there are new releases. And there's a film that should be streaming any minute that came out in the fall called Monster, that is also, I think, a masterwork. It's by Koreeda, the same director who did Shoplifters, that won the Oscar some years back.
Okay, yeah.
And I would say my other big pleasure right now is more, it's more of a listening experience than a watching experience, but I am about 17 and a half hours into the Barbra Streisand audiobook.
Oh, wow.
Which I, you must have other friends who are listening to it because
I'm listening.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
I'm just finishing up the sandbox. So I know there's another like 20 hours left and I'm not quite sure if I'm going to make it all the way, but I'm kind of determined because it's so, it's the best drive time listening you'll ever do.
It's great. It is. It can be approached like a podcast and listened to in, you know, 40 to 60 minute increments.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the, you know, yeah, that's the way to get through it. I would like to get back to All of Us Strangers quickly and just,
sure.
I mean, may I ask?
Happy to.
What did you do with yourself at the end of it? Just physically, emotionally, okay. Like what was your self-care?
Well, I'm still here, so I didn't jump off a building, but you know, mm-hmm. obviously the thought occurs. No, it's funny because I saw it with my husband and we just couldn't talk to each other afterward. We were completely speechless and we saw it. It was back last fall, it was at a screening at the Lamely on Sunset, you know, in the mall there. Mm-hmm. And we came out and we got into the elevator to go down to parking. And there were two other gentlemen in the elevator who were not together, who had also just seen the movie. And the elevator door closed and the four of us just stared at each other because nobody could say anything. And then as if on cue, we all just burst into laughter because we were so, it was such a moment of acknowledging you cannot talk after you've seen this film.
That was, I may have been at that exact screening.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was also my experience. It was a screening at which I knew a lot of the people who were coming in. And so there was this sort of the nod that conveys, we'll talk after.
Yep.
And there was no talking after. I went with my partner and he and I even like needed to just be, just be still for a moment. Yeah, it was, yeah. I found it, you know, for as unbelievably emotionally pulverizing as it was, like strangely hopeful. I didn't it wasn't a desperate sad. It was like a hopeful.
It's not depressing. It's just profound about the sadness that we all live with and the difficulty of connection. And of course, all kinds of issues about where our own perception of reality falls short.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Andrew's a friend. I'm actually working with him on something now, but I've just told him over and over how much I love the movie, but I'm very hesitant to dig because I almost feel like it would be an intrusion.
Sure.
What sure. did you really mean? No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. I found myself feeling like it had been made specifically for me, which is, you know, it's a nice feeling. Down to Frankie Goes to Hollywood, you know, I mean.
Well, the musical choices in there were amazing. It's been a long time since there's been, I mean, all of us, I mean, I think many of us grew up as little gay boys who were afraid of the disapproval of the world and afraid to come out to our parents and afraid of being tormented or actually being tormented by peers. And this movie speaks so intimately to that little boy inside of you. And I feel like there have been other books and films in history that have done that, but not to this level and not for a long time. And also the whole notion of some of the shame that you might carry from an early age, just from your being aware of being different, had been like a kind of a taboo subject in past years when we're all supposed to be just celebrating all of our gender diversity. And God knows I've made enough shows that have tried to celebrate that. But just to have somebody who says, don't be afraid of the loneliness and don't be afraid of the shame because it is part of what formed who you are. It's devastating, but also kind of liberating in a way.
Right. Loved it. And don't need to see it again. Not only because of the emotional devastation factor, but also because I am not in any danger of forgetting a single frame of it.
No, I know. I mean, I was like, afterwards, I was like, I have to see it again right away. And then that goes away. But then it becomes like, can I do this again? But I will. I will.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be a minute.
Alan, what did you grow up obsessed with in terms of pop culture, art?
I grew up obsessed primarily with theater, and always, not what I'm doing right now, obviously, but always wanted to have a career in musical theater. That was my lodestar. And I grew up in Philly with very enlightened parents. And that was in the days when, you know, Broadway shows would come through Philly on their way to Broadway and have tryouts. And so, or national tours. And so they always took me to see musicals. And it was like, that was like, you know, basically getting my rocks off as a 6-year-old, you know, and seeing My Fair Lady. And so that was, so I became obsessed with original cast albums and with who were Broadway stars and the Tony Awards. And that was, I think, the main obsession. I loved movies as well. I loved entertainment, but I would say probably the second to theater would be sitcoms, because I loved growing up with sitcoms, which I also thought were an incredibly, not like sitcoms spoke personally to me, but still somehow the comfort of the tropes of the sitcom and the laughter and feeling like you were part of a greater whole with a studio audience that you knew was actually sitting there and actually laughing. It was something that it gave me a sense of belonging, I think.
What were your formative sitcoms?
Well, going way, way back, I would say, because I'm a little bit just before Brady Bunch when I was a kid. So it was more like, I mean, as a teeny kid, it was more like Bewitched. And then, of course, Mary Tyler Moore Show. And then as we start growing up, you get into Cheers and Frasier and that whole stable of shows.
Yeah.
And Maud. I think Maud was a touchstone for me. I think, I mean, if you don't know you're gay when you see Bea Arthur and have that reaction to her.
Totally.
So totally. True.
There's such a special comfort, though, also, as you say, to those shows. There's a warmth to them that is missing from sitcoms in large part now, I feel.
Yes. Well, first of all, it was when we could all, like, America could sit down and watch something together in a communal kind of state, and it was, everybody was watching because it was on at the same time. And also that there were the conventions of the kinds of jokes that were funny and the kinds of jokes that were good and what would make you laugh or what make the audience go ooh. It was all, I mean, we were still pretending that we had one unified popular culture, and even though that was of course a big lie, there was especially when you're too young to have a strong sense of personal identity, especially with regards to any kind of being any part of any kind of minority or subset of society, it was there was great comfort. It was comfort food, and it was used to sell junk food. And so it was I don't believe that there's a great cultural loss in the fragmentation of our society as we come to recognize how diverse we are. But I do think there was the illusion of being a unified popular culture as taught to us by network TV and commercials is something that I feel very nostalgic towards.
You know what holds up remarkably well, I just want to recommend, is Family Ties. You can get it on Family Ties. Pluto. Mm.
I wouldn't expect it to hold up.
It's fantastic. The writing is so much better than I remembered it being funny, but even now from today's perspective, it's really sharp. Justine Bateman is like a genius. Of course,
Justine Bateman is great. But now we know Justine is a genius. Listening to Justine, I got more insight out of Justine Bateman about the SAG strike and the AI issues that were going on than from anybody else commentating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She's incredible. She's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess that was apparent even then.
Even then. Pluto TV, there's a whole channel for it.
Oh, really? I mean, assume you guys watched WandaVision.
I did.
I did not.
Or did you not? Yeah, because that's why, especially the first half of the episodes of WandaVision was so, because it was really playing on explaining all those tropes that I grew up with. And it was like a sort of taking off a different sitcom each episode. And I thought the director, Matt Shakman, did such a brilliant job with it. That was, I mean, I would to see the Marvel Cinematic Universe reaching out to please my little gay boy roots. That's just something I thought would never happen.
Incredible. Yeah. You had a major hand, I mean, in so many shows, but I mean, as Dave said, for me, two shows in particular that had a big impact on me, Six Feet Under and My So-Called Life. And I mean, let's start with My So-Called Life. I don't even have a great question. I just want to hear you talk about it. And I mean, literally any anecdote, any memory, anything you've got, I'll take it.
With My So-Called Life, that was, I mean, Six Feet Under, Tales of the City, all those shows since then, I was there from on the ground floor, from the putting together of the show from the very beginning. My So-Called Life was not that. I wasn't really experienced in television. And I had done a special with Edswick and Marshall Herskovitz, the creators of My So-Called Life. And they were a little less than halfway through filming the first, the first and only season. Mm. And there was, for whatever reason, they felt they had to bring in a new producer. And because we had had such a good experience working on the special, they asked me if I would come in and take over. And so I was late to the party. The show had already been cast. They had already shot, I think, five or six. So it was not, I didn't have any proprietary stake in the show. However, being there with, I mean, that cast, they were teenagers and they were all incredibly talented, obviously, and all bringing everything to it. But when you're at that age and when you're doing a show that's about teen romance and about teen insecurity and about the crushes that come and go and the indignities that you have to suffer, and you're a teenager who's actually living that also when you're not on set, it was I want to say hand-holding, but it was almost hand-holding, shoulder-holding. I felt like being there as emotional support for all the cast as they were going through, sometimes they were going through things that had nothing to do with what was in the script, and sometimes they were going through things that had to do with confusion about what were their real feelings as opposed to the feelings that the character was supposed to be feeling. And so it was just such an emotionally draining but rewarding experience because really, I was the onset presence for, as directors came and went, but for those kids who were really being put through something that was extremely challenging for, also because as you know, the caliber of the writing was so high. I mean, Winnie Holzman's a genius, and it was so emotionally deep that the writing had the ability to affect the performers on a level far beyond what a normal teen drama would do.
And they seem like a cast that has been taken care of. You know, they all seem to have like moved into adulthood pretty well.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them have done well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you came halfway through the party on My So-Called Life. Did Tino ever show up? That's my favorite trope in My So-Called Life. Yeah, is that there's a line in every episode that like Tino's going to come and pick him up, and there's just we never do see Tino.
No,
we never do.
Even with a second season, I don't think you would have. But
no, that's, you need a character who you never actually see.
I mean, I know the last thing we need in this world is another reboot, but my God, a revival of My So-Called Life, those characters, those actors, at the stage of life they're in now, high school reunion. I mean, I'm ready.
Yeah, good. I hope you find somebody to make it for you. No. I'm not. I really don't want to go to that reunion.
Well, let's talk about Six Feet Under, because, you know, obviously there's the finale episode, but for me, I think the second most memorable one, for better or worse, is That's My Dog. Directed by Alan Poole.
Thank you for saying that.
And yeah, I'm sure listeners remember, but this is the one where Michael C. Hall's character picks up a guy thinking they're going to hook up. And then that guy robs him, forces him to smoke crack or meth or something, pours gasoline on him, puts a gun in his mouth at some point, I think. I mean, it is dark. And it's sort of controversial, but it's interesting. People are still kind of grappling with it. Like, I just as I was sitting down to talk to you, I was like, it's so strange because I've had two different conversations about that episode in like the last 2 weeks with two different
Seriously?
People. Well, yeah.
I'm glad. Well, it's because the show's on Netflix now. So I guess a lot of people are either rewatching or getting to see it for the first time. But that's my dog. It's funny. When we conceived of that episode as a departure episode, which it obviously is. But the inspiration for it very specifically was there's a famous episode of The Sopranos called Pine Barrens, where where they're chasing the Russian guy through the frozen Pine Barrens of New Jersey. And like with most shows, like with Six Feet Under, like with Sopranos, normally you are constantly balancing A, B, C storylines between different groups of characters. But in the Pine Barrens, what David Chase did was he then hijacked the episode. So the second half of the episode, there was no respite. You never cut away from this very tense chase through the snowy woods. And essentially, the episode was hijacked by one story for the final 30 minutes. And we were like, oh, that was brilliant. We could do that. And so we came up with this premise that David and his carjacker were going to hijack the story. And Scott Buck wrote it, and we worked very closely together on it. And I think we knew when making it that it did, I mean, you know, working with Michael C. Hall and Michael Weston, who played the other character, they were so willing to go there to the emotional depths. And we rehearsed a lot and rehearsed it as if it was not the story of of one man torturing another, but rather we rehearsed it as if it was the story of a failed relationship. Like it started off well, and then the relationship just got worse and worse. And I think that came through. And we were very, very proud of the episode. It wasn't until it went on the air that we realized the impact it was going to have on people. And that impact, there was an argument, because there was an argument that said, there's an unspoken agreement with the audience that you're not going to throw a monkey wrench at them, and that they love and trust your characters, and in return you won't undermine that trust. And there were people who felt we had broken that verbal contract by putting them in a situation that was terrifying that they couldn't get away from. And I was kind of like, yeah, mission accomplished. That's kind of what we wanted to do. But there were people, my husband among them, there were people who were huge fans of the show who vowed not to watch anymore after that. And then, you know, eventually everybody came back. But I had not anticipated that. And there was a big piece in New York Magazine at that time about that episode and how it had divided the world of Six Feet Under fans into those who thought it was brilliant and those who thought it was a betrayal. But I'm glad it holds up.
It does. It's traumatizing. And I think that there are people felt that it was, I don't know, sending some people argued that it was, I guess, sending sort of the wrong message about, you know, that it was like every fear of David as a gay man is coming true suddenly. But it's this cautionary tale. But I don't know. It's interesting thinking of it almost as a love story, because there is such a relationship between them.
It is a relationship, and it was more almost like it was half like a father-son relationship.
Yeah.
And half like a love story, but I just never thought of it in the context of being David's internalized homophobia. I mean, David had internalized phobias about a lot of things, but it was the equivalent of, you know, it's a little grandiose comparison, but like in Psycho, where you think you're following the story of Janet Leigh, and then the thing happens. And it's meant to upset the audience and turn their expectations upside down. But that was, I think that's done a lot more often in television now.
Yeah.
But at that time, it still wasn't done. The idea was that TV was meant to tell you what it was going to be and then be true to what it told you it was going to be.
You know, you mentioned David's internalized homophobia, and I think an episode that really does, another iconic episode you directed is the one called Everybody Sleeps.
Nobody sleeps. Yeah.
Nobody sleeps. I'm sorry. And the client is a gay man who's planning his partner's funeral, and he wants the funeral to be an opera. And David is struggling with like the stereotypes this brings up. And it kind of distills a lot of his struggles with being the gay Fisher, like over the course of the series. But what stands out to you when you think about that episode?
I mean, I loved that episode. As a little bit of trivia, you know that the client in that episode was played by Dennis Christopher, who had been the star of Breaking Away when he was young. And Dennis gives, I think, a brilliant performance. But in terms of, for me, on the technical side, the pinnacle of it was that we were able to build an opera set inside the funeral home with a full-on scrim and everything, and do in-camera the lighting change of the scrim, revealing the coffin behind it. And that was just sort of like a really fun thing to do technically on a TV show. But for me, it's about David being transformed by listening to the Puccini. And David, one of their friends gets up and sings Nessun Dorma, the famous aria from Turandot, that literally means nobody sleeps, which is always the title of the episode. And David, who's been made uncomfortable by the flamboyant display of same-sex love and opera love and all the gayishness of the Enterprise, when he sees that man stand up and sing the solo, and then we push in close on David watching it and understanding that this entire thing has been about the great testament of the love of one man for another, and you see him transformed, that to me was, that's what the episode was about.
When you were younger, when you were, whatever your coming out journey was, how much David was in you?
I think, there's a little David in all of us who had to struggle to come out, but David was wound very tight, put it that way. And I was not necessarily a free spirit, but not so much. I came out my freshman year in college, but I actually had, in my senior year in high school, I had come out by confessing to my best friend that I was in love with him, and that went really badly.
Ooh.
That went really badly, but it left me with the resolve that, okay, so I know I need to take this to the next level.
What was the aftermath of that experience, if I may?
Well, was it the end of the school? The aftermath of that experience was that I stopped being friends with this person because their response was not, and it, remember, it was a different time. It wasn't a time when you had a GSA club in every high school, or where it was common to have anybody out in your class. But his response was, well, I don't know what you want me to do about that, but I can't deal with that, and I have no interest in dealing with it. But we can go on being friends. And I was like, no,
we can't.
Yeah.
Did you anticipate a different reaction? I mean, I'm assuming that he was straight.
Yes, and still is, to the best of my knowledge. But of course you anticipate a different reaction. You're a kid. You anticipate that things will turn out okay.
Or
at least a level of kind of comfort, or something, empathy, maybe.
Understanding.
None of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I must ask how Tales of the City came to you. Were you familiar with the stories?
Oh, of course. I had read all the books. I mean, the time when we did the first series, I think there were the six books had come out, the first six, but not the last three, obviously. But it just happened that I was working at a company called Propaganda Films. This is in the 90s. Propaganda Films started as a music video director company. It was one of the first director-driven companies. And when they started getting into scripted, I had done a show for them and I had done a movie for them. And they knew that I was queer. And so when they were actually sister companies with Working Title. You're probably familiar with Working Title because they're still around in the studio. And they had, Working Title in the UK had gotten the rights to the books, but they knew that it had to be shot in the States. And so they brought it to me and said, hey, are you interested in this? And I was like, am I? And so that began my very long association with Armistead and with the series, which we've now done four of.
I mean, now that is a formative viewing experience.
Thank you.
That was, I believe, my senior year of college, watching kind of furtively. I was half out, half in. I mean, it is it's so faithfully done and so beautifully done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, it's interesting because it was developed by Channel 4 in the UK, one of the private networks in the UK, and Channel 4's approach to any prized piece of literature is that fidelity is everything. is that, okay, let's look at this page and let's look at this page and let's look at this page and we'll adapt each page as it comes, because that's the sort of masterpiece theater approach to it, which is rather different from American series adaptation rules. And so I think it was the fact that it was Channel 4's being so intent on being faithful that helped the show to stay that way. The funny thing about the first, which is, I still have a very soft spot in my heart for the original series. It was on in 1994, but you forget, you watch it now, and it's like that could be on Nickelodeon. It's like a sweet, there are some breasts, but other, it's like a sweet little, slightly PG, slightly spicy level of sexual content. But it's because it's so warm and loving. But when that came out in 1994, there were bomb threats. We were denounced on the floor of several state legislatures. We were. It was. There was a famously, and there was a like a 6-minute excerpt of all the worst bits from the original Tales of the City that was made on, they made a VHS because it was those days, and the VHS containing just like those dirty bits was deposited in the office of every single member of the United States Congress. Somebody paid for all those VHS dupes, and if you turn it on, it would be just like, bitch, ass, two men kissing, a naked breast, up yours, back, and it was like just like that, just the high points. But even at that, it's nothing. I mean, it's comforting that it's an indication of how far we've come, but there is nothing at all salacious about it, and yet PBS backed out of doing the second series.
And Senator Kennedy of Louisiana just did the exact same thing with the racier parts of genderqueer.
Oh, I didn't. Did he do an excerpt reel?
The exact same thing. Yeah, he just read them. He read all of the more salacious parts,
Everyone
which,
loves a good excerpt reel,
yeah, with a foghorn leghorn voice. But it is that series is so, as somebody who's in the middle of coming out at the time, the idea of community in that world was so, like, comforting is not the word, like nourishing. The idea that there was such a thing as like a diverse community to sort of find yourself in, to land in at some
I
point.
think one of the great things that Armistead did in the, it was originally serialized in the San Francisco Chronicle, but one of the great things that he did in those early books was he really firmly established the idea of the chosen family, which was really the refuge for many queer men and women when they came out and lost support from their biological families. And the idea of the family is the people that you put together who support you. And I feel like the original Tales was one of the pioneering visions of that. And actually, Armistead even coined the term of, because there's your biological family. And he said, in opposition to that, there's your logical family, which is the people that you need to be surrounded by.
There's a new book coming out. There's a new Tales of the City book on the
Yes,
way.
I've read
Okay. It's on
it.
its
I
way to
can't,
us now.
I
There's
know I've
talk
read
of
it. I can't give you any spoilers, but
There's talk of Armistead Maupin coming on the show. We'll see.
that's right. Any tips on talking to him?
If I would, it would be great to have. I'm talking to him next week. If you want me to,
Great.
give you a plug, I'd be happy to.
Oh, I appreciate that.
You
Yeah, I
don't
think
need any
it's.
tips talking to Armistead. Armistead is the easiest person in the world to talk to. He
I
is
bet.
delightful. He's always got an anecdote at the ready. Most of his anecdotes are R-rated, but you don't have a problem with that. So there
Not
you
one
go.
bit. That's
Not
kind.
one bit. Not one bit. Laura Linney on that show arrives like 100% fully formed Laura Linney.
It's amazing because Laura had done some. Well, she was already very accomplished on stage, and she had done some standout bits in movies, like in Lorenzo's Oil and Searching for Bobby Fischer, where she had like a few scenes, but you immediately popped and you're, who's that person? But Laura came in on Tales to read for the role of Dee Dee, because being, kind of reflexively faithful to the books, in the books, Dee Dee was the blonde and Marianne was the brunette. But then when we found Laura and saw the range that she had, it was very clear that she was not gonna, she would be too limited as Dee Dee. And we asked her to come back in and read for Marianne. And we said, to hell with what the hair color says.
It
And
works.
yeah, it works. And Laura has been, I mean, one of the reasons we've been able to make four series is because Laura has stayed so loyal to Armistead and to the books, and it just always makes herself available.
You have this, as you mentioned, this, you know, strong connection to Japan, where you shoot Tokyo Vice, of course. I believe you've even been made a tourism ambassador by the city of Tokyo.
Yes, I have. I am officially a tourism ambassador for the Tokyo Metropolitan Government.
Very impressive. First, you spent time there in high school as an exchange student, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So talk to us about that chapter. Young Alan Poole goes over there and looks for a Japanese version of My Fair Lady, or what was that?
What happened was that when I was in high school, it was a program where you competed to be the exchange student from your high school for that year, but you didn't get to choose what country you went to. And then supposedly the organization matched you with the perfect family for you in whatever country they were in, which is, I don't think that's the way it really worked. But so I was selected, and then just about 3 weeks before departure, and I was like going, oh, France, please let it be France. I got this packet in the mail, and there was the picture of this family, and they said, congratulations, this is your new family. And it's this beautiful Japanese family in the beautiful ancient Japanese city of Nara. I don't know if you've been, but Nara is a magical place in Japan. It was the first permanent capital, meaning it was the capital of Japan for most of the 8th century, before Kyoto was even a city. So I landed with this great family in this magical place. I discovered I had, for whatever reason, a kind of affinity for the culture, for the language especially. And having had that experience as a relatively sheltered, you know, suburban Philly theater-struck kid, I didn't want to let it go. When I started college, as I told you, I was theater-struck. So my parents made only one request. They said, please, don't be a drama major. You can always go to drama school, but, you know, we're paying a lot of money, learn something academic. And I was like, all right, well, then I'm going to major in Japanese literatures. And they were like, fine, great. They were not, to their great credit, they didn't care if I was going to be pre-law or pre-med or even thinking about a career. They just wanted me to work my brain. And so I ended up getting my degree in Japanese language and literature and spending my junior year again in Tokyo, doing nothing but attending a very intensive language institute for an entire year. And that's where I really mastered the language. And that's where I had come out my freshman year, but not on campus. And then I kind of came out on campus my sophomore year, but it was really in Japan that because I was living in an apartment by myself, that I started really living a life in the subculture, which was kind of amazing because it was a rather different subculture than what you would expect here.
How so? Yeah, it must have been thrilling. I mean, you got to sort of reinvent yourself.
I did. And I also was having a double life in that I was going to school with all these, it was a combination of undergrads and grad students who were all very intent on studying various arcane fields of Japanese studies and working on the language night and day. And then I had another life after dark, where I would go out and nobody from my school was out. So I would go out and had to make my own way in Nichome, which is the gay part of Shinjuku then and still now, and make my own friends and figure out which bars to go to and get over my fear. And that was my chosen family in Japan.
What was
your logical family?
What was your bar in Japan?
Have you been to Tokyo? The gay bars there are about as big as your living room. You know, they're not, I mean, they weren't big gay dance bars then, not at all. So it was in this one district, there were a bunch of bars and you would spend the night going back and forth to different ones. But the one that I went to when I was a student was called Sazae, and it doesn't exist anymore. But it was like being in someone's living room, and it generally was like half foreigners and half Japanese. And the general rule was the foreigners were looking to meet up with Japanese guys and the Japanese were looking to meet up with foreign guys. And if you were a Japanese guy looking for a Japanese guy, that you'd go to it. That's a different bar you'd go to.
Mm-hmm. What was the music like?
Oh, same as disco. Uh-huh. Same. I mean, that, you know, by that point, I think that disco pop R&B, pop R&B had become pretty universal. It's not like they played Japanese music. You're much more likely to hear Japanese music in a in a gay bar now than you were then, because now with the ascent of J-pop, K-pop, and on and city pop, which is so big, there's a lot more Japanese pop music that's big on the world music scene. But then that wasn't the case then.
Yeah, it's good to know that disco transcends and is truly global.
It was, you know, it nurtured me for years.
I love it. I love it.
How did you meet your husband?
I met my husband online, but on a web-based site that, because when we met, we met in 2007. So it was still the age of AOL chat rooms and web-based sites, and it was pre-mobile apps. So that was the place where you went, and we met, but it was very old-fashioned. We met, and it took a long time till we actually met in person. We carried on much conversation on the site, more his choice than mine, but he's very careful and cautious person. And then finally we met up, and here we are 15 years later.
A courtship is a beautiful thing. However,
it was a true courtship. It. Yeah. And I, you know, I think real courtships like that have been pretty rare for me. Usually it's more like you meet, you like each other, you decide to hang out, you know?
Yeah. When you go to Tokyo for long stretches to do the show, does he come with you?
My husband is a teacher. He teaches AP English in a private high school in LA. And so it used to be, before he started teaching, I had the rigorous schedule and it was easier for him to come and travel with me. But nobody has a tougher schedule than a teacher. And so now we've had, particularly with Tokyo Vice and with the show I did in Paris before that called The Eddie, we've had some painfully long separations, and where he's only been able to come and visit me on vacations, you know, or vice versa. So it's been tough, but in the end, I think it's made the relationship stronger because we have weathered those separations and we are closer than ever.
Was there a moment when you felt as though you knew that he was the one?
Yeah. I mean,
if you're not comfortable sharing,
well,
that's
I'm
fine
just going to
but...
say it's. Well, I don't like to share, but it happened very quickly for me, and that's very rare in my experience that I had this feeling. And so the courtship was, I was the courter. Mm-hmm. That's the right word, courter, courtier.
Mm-hmm. We'll accept it.
I went a courting.
Uh huh. Great. Excellent.
But it's you know. To say that it's the greatest relationship in my life is like such a crazy understatement, because I never had a relationship that went longer than 3 years before we met. And now this is, you know, this is it.
Yeah. 15 years is no joke. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on season 2 of Tokyo Vice, streaming now on Max. Everybody check it out. Alan Poole, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I hope I didn't get too confessional on you.
No such thing.
There's really not any such thing, but thank you.
All right. Good to know. All right. Thank you, guys.
And that is our show. Please do give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Instagram at HomophiliaPod. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, music by Ben Wise. Our executive producer is Renee Colvert. Our associate producer is Jess Walensky, and our audio engineer is Justin Mattson. Many thanks to Michael Pressman and everyone at World of Wonder.